It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up, we find out what sets humans apart from the rest of the animal kingdom when it comes to crying.
First, we're going to be getting an on-the-ground report of what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri. Some are describing the town now as being on the brink of chaos, pending a grand jury decision on whether police officer Darren Wilson will be indicted for the death of Michael Brown. In August, Wilson fatally shot Brown, an unarmed African-American teenager. That, in turn, has ignited a national conversation on race and policing.
Protests have mostly been peaceful in the last few months, but many in Ferguson are preparing for violence in the streets. Governor Jay Nixon has called on extra police forces to handle demonstrations after the grand jury decision is announced. And in fact, the governor declared a state of emergency ahead of the ruling on the Ferguson shooting. Local gun store owners are also telling reporters that gun sales are up.
Emmanuel Berry is with us again to talk about what's happening in Ferguson. She is a reporting fellow who covers race, culture, and diversity for St. Louis Public Radio. And Emmanuel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with the news that we just heard a short time ago, that Missouri Governor Jay Nixon has declared a state of emergency ahead of that ruling on the indictment. Any big surprises there, and what has the reaction been?
I don't think it's a surprise to anyone. In his speech last week, he said that the National Guard could be called on in the event that, you know, things do turn violent. So this is kind of just the formal process of allowing him to call upon the National Guard. So it's a 30-day state of emergency is what he's called for currently. It also, in addition to calling on the National Guard, it also formalizes the Unified Command, which is the St. Louis County Police, the St. Louis City Police, and the Missouri Highway Patrol. They will be working together on responses, once again, if things do get hectic in St. Louis in the next couple of weeks.
And I want to talk about some of the preparations that have been going on from a couple of different angles. And I want to start with, I think it was a story that you wrote, perhaps over the weekend, about some of the preparations that businesses and others are taking. And I think the lead for the story was something along the lines of, it looks as though a storm is approaching. You know, there's plywood over the business windows and so forth. How widespread is that sort of preparation?
Well, you go to Ferguson, and the area where there's a lot of plywood that's been put up on stores, those are stores that were the ones that were looted, and that the ones that did have vandalism. In early August, there were a couple nights of protests that did turn violent, and a lot of those stores were the ones that were impacted, had their windows broken through, or actually had stuff taken. Since then, protests have been relatively peaceful, but I think a lot of those businesses are like, I don't want to go through this again. So they're putting up plywood kind of as a safeguard because they're worried that things will be like they were in August. But at the same time, there are a couple of businesses in Ferguson, and this is like their main business strip that's near the apartment complex where Michael Brown was shot, that are saying, we're not going to put up plywood. We trust the community. You know, we think that the community is going to take care of this, so they're going to be respectful. So they've made it a point, you know, that amongst all these other businesses next to them putting up their plywood, that they're not going to do it. It's mainly in a concentrated business districts in Ferguson. The other business district in Ferguson, I've heard some of them talking about possibly putting up plywood and boarding up. But once again, there's other businesses that are making a point, like, we're not going to do that. This is our community.
And at the same time, the police have been pretty visible in terms of talking about kind of what they're thinking. And I heard over the weekend a program on St. Louis Public Radio where you had the chief and some other folks in talking about this is what happened before. And they also addressed this proposed rules of engagement that the Don't Shoot Coalition has come out with. If you could talk a little bit about what the authorities, the police are saying, how they're planning to react, and then try to tie it together with this Don't Shoot Coalition and those rules of engagement they talked about.
So I think what that kind of conversation is about more than anything is that there are there's common ground between what protesters want and what police want, and that is that they not all protesters, but protest leaders don't want things to get violent. They don't want things to get out of hand, and neither do police. They want people to be able to exercise their rights, and I think so do police. So they're really trying to find common ground. So police have made a point, you know, that their violence will not be tolerated, and that's something that Nixon said in his speech and that police are also following up with. But the rules of engagement that have been proposed by this coalition, you know, are letting minor kind of infractions go, allowing, you know, protesters to peacefully protest, really just kind of basic things to prevent things from escalating like they did last time where we had, you know, riot gear and tear gas coming out. So it's to get it so that it doesn't get to that point. So, yeah, it's really about trying to find common ground between police and protesters. And police say they have been engaging with protesters and talking to them. So they haven't formally agreed to anything, but I think there is a sense of cooperation in some ways for this upcoming decision.
Now, you've been following the story quite closely for months now, and as we get closer to this announcement of what the grand jury findings are going to be, do you mention that sense of maybe there's some sense of cooperation here, but then I you know, you see other media coverage and you hear brink of chaos and it's just about to explode and those sorts of things. What's your sense of the mood, or is it just too wide ranging of a series of events to really for any one person to get that sense?
I would say it does feel a little bit like there's a brink, or it feels like we're preparing for a storm here, as I kind of said in my piece. And there are people who are like, you know, people need to calm down, et cetera. But I think like social media has kind of played into this hysteria. Neighbors are, I was talking to a woman who was talking about getting a gun. And this is someone who the last thing that she wants in her house is a gun, completely against it. But because of what she's been hearing on social media and for others, she's kind of fed into a sense of hysteria about it. And that's something that some of the local leaders have been saying. Charlie Dooley, who is the St. Louis County executive, in his speech last week along with Mayor Slay was saying, you know, we can't just assume that, you know, things are going to turn violent. You know, we have to look at this as a best situation kind of thing. And I think a lot of people are assuming that things are going to turn violent, which is why there is kind of this sense of chaos in the community. And everyone's on edge. I would say that a lot of people are on edge about what's going to come because we've been waiting for this decision for months now. And it's kind of like the other point, you know, we felt like we had just gone through the beginning of the storm during those initial protests in August when things were violent, and we've been in the eye of the storm for a long time, and we're waiting for that other half of it to come, which is this announcement. And I guess that's kind of how it feels.
And any updates on when you expect that announcement to happen? As you say, everybody's been waiting, but is there a when yet?
Not a for sure when. I think McCullough has made it very clear, you know, that when the decision comes down, he'll let people know. What we're expecting, I guess, is before the month is up. So in the next 2 weeks to hear this decision. And, yeah, we're just preparing. Everyone's just preparing.
Well, Emmanuel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Emmanuel Berry, who is a reporting fellow who covers race, culture, and diversity for St. Louis Public Radio. She provided us with an update on what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri. Trainloads of sand continue to be hauled out of Wisconsin to be used in oil and gas drilling projects in other states. Some of the so-called fracking sites are controversial, and some people living near the drill zones have a message for the frack sand industry. Chuck Quirnbach went to southern Mississippi for a look.
Just off a rural highway near Macomb, Mississippi, freelance journalist Tina Casagrand takes out her binoculars. She looks across a cow pasture to some equipment about a quarter mile south. Casagrand describes what she can see of a fracking operation.
There's a lot of red clay dirt, some Mississippi clay there, and there's a gas pump well, and there's some orange flames burning really constantly.
The drilling site, complete with natural gas being flared off, is one of several in southwest Mississippi operated by the Encana Corporation. The firm says it uses Wisconsin and Minnesota frack sand at some of its fracking wells. But this fall, Encana would not let a group from the Society of Environmental Journalists on its property, saying the work crew there was not equipped to handle a tour group. However, Don Briggs of the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association did explain how the fracking sand is used underground. He says an injection of sand and water helps keep open what he calls bullet holes in the fractured rock.
Otherwise, if you didn't have the sand in it, they close right up and, you know, you have no production at all. So the quality of the sand is so important in the different formations.
The digging of Wisconsin sand has created jobs and health controversies in the Badger State. Closer to the fracking, the use of the sand for oil and gas extraction remains of concern to many citizens and environmental groups. Scott Eustace of the Gulf Restoration Network says even in usually wet southern Mississippi and Louisiana, the need for a water-sand mix is threatening some waterways.
You know, just this process involves so much water, and it's being taken out of some of the only protected streams in Louisiana, streams that the environmental movement has spent 30 years preserving so that those rivers are actually swimmable.
Others raise concerns about the methane released into the air at the fracking operations and the potential for groundwater pollution. Louisiana State University professor David Dismukes heads the school's Center for Energy Studies. He acknowledges there are environmental issues, but says so far economic development has ruled the day.
It's been increased job opportunities. You've got corporations that are putting regional headquarters in those locations that are in turn creating middle management positions.
But some communities, perhaps those with more economic power, are trying to say no to the fracking boom. At St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana, just north across Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans, opposition has been particularly strong. Community activist Stephanie Houston Gray has a request for Wisconsin firms that supply frack sand.
I would just ask that you take responsibility, too, for the consequences of your choices on the environment for all of us. We share a global community. Louisiana is not that far away from Wisconsin. We both are states, you know, rimmed with water. We love our outdoor activities. We want to keep it safe for people in Louisiana, and I know you want to keep it safe for people in Wisconsin.
Houston Gray would like the two states to be partners in environmental protection, but the political reality is that some Louisiana lawmakers are pushing hard this month in favor of another project with petroleum ties, the Keystone XL pipeline. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in New Orleans.
Crying is one of the most basic emotional responses in humans. In fact, we are the only living creatures who cry for emotional reasons.
But why do we cry? And why do we get pleasure from crying in some instances? These are among the questions our next guest explored in his book, Why Humans Like to Cry: Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
Michael Trimble is an emeritus professor of behavioral neurology at the Institute for Neurology in London. And Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very, very pleased to be in touch with you.
I want to start out with sort of the premise of the book, because I have to say, I thought it was going to be easier than it was. But all of a sudden, I'm reading about Nietzsche, and I'm reading about neurophysiology, and I'm reading about evolution. And crying, which seems so simple on its face, really is not simple at all.
Well, yes, I think there's a difficulty in the way that maybe I have to approach the book as a neuroscientist. And one of the things that intrigues me is to think about brain processing in humans, Homo sapiens, that's our species, in relationship to our hominid ancestors and indeed our earlier ape ancestors. So if it is true that only humans cry emotionally, and our species has been on the planet for, nobody quite knows, but anything between 250,000 years and perhaps a million years. The question is, to what extent are our brains different that allow us this facility not only to cry emotionally, but also to be able to get some pleasure or meaning from crying? So the book is very much orientated towards some neuroanatomy. I often tell my friends who I give copies of the book to say, well, you know, read the first two chapters and the last two, and I'll forgive you if you miss out the middle bit.
Well, it is complicated, but there is an awful lot there. And I have to ask you, why, as someone who could, you know, there are any number of topics you could have chosen to write about, what is it about crying that really intrigued you and made you want to sit down and do the research and do the book?
Thank you very much. The point is that for many years I have been involved in research into those areas of the brain, particularly the human brain, that relate to our emotions. So much neuroscience and neurology has been concerned with cognition, that is, you know, thinking and logic and how we can do things with movements, praxis. But there's also an undercurrent that has looked at the way our emotions influence our cognitions, our emotions influencing the way we think. And certainly when you begin to look at emotions and our emotional responses, there are certain things that lead people to crying for emotional reasons. Now, I don't want to suggest that emotions are the only reasons that we cry. So, you know, if somebody puts salt in your eye or you get an infection, then you can get tears. But what's interested me is why we cry emotionally, for emotional reasons, and other animals on the planet do not do so. And I cry to a number of things. But one of the things that really leads me to cry, and also 90% of the people that we survey, is music. So I started going from the neuroanatomy, looking for differences in the human brain in relationship to, say, a chimpanzee brain, but then asking what things lead us specifically to crying. Now, bereavement, of course, and sadness and loss are universal, and that is a universal experience. But when we started looking at the arts, the interesting thing was that if you ask people if they cry to music, to poetry, to paintings, to architecture, to sculpture, 80 or 90% of people will say, yes, music releases tears. It's about 60% with poetry, but when you become, when you get down to asking about crying to looking at a painting or a sculpture, you're really down to the 5% level. So there's something special about music, and I was interested in that because music is certainly one of the things that leads me to cry. So that was really the basis of trying to explore the links between crying and art, and in particular art and tragedy, the art of tragedy. Why do we go to the theater to see tragedy and cry and feel better afterwards?
And going back to the music, what did you find in terms of the type of music that elicits these strong emotions within us?
Well, that's a very interesting question, too. I'm personally rather interested in sort of romantic classical music as the provocateur of crying. But, you know, any piece of music that has autobiographical relevance, in other words, the relevance for our lives personally, can lead to crying. So, you know, you hear a tune on the radio and it was the tune when you first fell in love, you know, 10, 20, 30, however many years ago it was, that can be very provocative. On the other hand, there may be tunes or music which is rather special to a family, but, you know, that's our tune, so to speak. But on the other hand, there are composers who just know how to lead people to cry, and whether you choose, you know, Puccini or Verdi or Wagner, somehow they knew how to make people cry with the music structure that they embedded into their pieces.
And one thing that I'm sorry to step on you there, but one thing that you hone in on as well is the opera specifically. And I think opera has a unique way of drawing someone into a story where, even if it's not autobiographical to us, we develop a certain amount of empathy, perhaps, for the protagonist. And those often end in tragedy, too. But opera, you highlight, is a unique form of music.
Well, that's extremely relevant because, you know, opera is a drama. I mean, you have an opera and there's no drama, you won't get much from it. So there's a drama on the stage, but the drama is compounded with music, and it's also often compounded with the poetry as well. So many operatic pieces have embedded within the original language a poetry that goes with the music. And it's considered that opera as we see it today is today's representative of what used to go on the Greek stage, the Greek tragic stage, 2,500 years ago. And so there you had a drama, you had religion, which is quite interesting. There were often religious festivals. They usually involved a protagonist who was a hero who suffered as a hero. But in terms of the performance, as today, on the stage, what people saw was a drama with poetry and music put into that. And so there's something very deep about the heritage of our artistic appreciation, which the Greeks at least captivated and has been captivating us ever since. And when you think about
Well, Michael, we will get back to that after the news. We're talking with Michael Trimble. He's author of Why Humans Like to Cry, Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
And we hope you'll get in touch with us, too. Have you noticed that certain situations, life experiences, or even songs are sure to make you cry? Do you find crying cathartic, or do you do everything you can to avoid it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Still to come, we look back a century ago at Wisconsin during World War I and how many of the food rationing programs were pioneered here.
Right now, we're talking with Michael Trimble, an emeritus professor of behavioral neurology at the Institute of Neurology and the author of the book we're talking about, Why Humans Like to Cry, Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
And we want to hear from you, too. What do you want to know about this uniquely human emotional response? What works of art move you? Do you derive pleasure from crying? Is it cathartic for you? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you could tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
We're going to be getting to our calls in just a moment, but before we do that, before the break, we were talking a lot about some of the things that make people cry. But Michael Trimble, we'd also like to talk about what's happening inside of our brains when we're getting that information, whether it's bad news or a piece of music or just something that, and I understand it's complicated. So what is the short version of what our brains are up to when we're making that sort of that decision, I guess, to cry?
Yeah, the short answer is that the feelings begin in the stomach. They're visceral, that's the word for it, and you get gut feelings. And the gut feelings are generated by parts of the nervous system, which are referred to as the autonomic nervous system. They're unconscious initially, and they the part of the nervous system that keeps us going, alters our emotional responses to our environment moment by moment. But the interesting thing and important thing about the human brain relates in particular to our memories and our autobiographical memories. It's arguable to what extent a chimpanzee, for example, has long-standing autobiographical memories, memories of personal experiences that go back to childhood. But from the human point of view, we know that many of our emotional responses are set up during our childhood period of time. And you know, I talked about music, and one of the most interesting things about music is our exposure to it when we're very, very young indeed. So what happens when a baby cries tears, that is, not just cries out, but cries tears, is that the mother will come to mollify the child. And what mother does is sing to the child. The whole voice of the female, the voice with which she will sing lullabies, are comforting to the child, to us. They mollify, they reduce the tension, and they obviously become embedded in a very, very personal relationship, bonding with the mother. Now, the mother does something else. She holds the baby, she rocks the baby, and so you also have movement and music early embedded into our conscious experiences of meeting the world in terms of loving relationships. so part of the reason that we cry, I think, to music certainly relates very much to that, to our very, very early experiences of music in lullabies and the way that that mothers sing to us. It's universal that mothers sing to babies. They sing in a frequency, a sound frequency, which is not the normal adult frequency, but it's a higher pitch frequency. Just happens to be the frequency which sopranos tend to sing during the opera. So, you know, there are links there between early linguistic musical experiences and responses to crying which are satisfactory, hence the possibility of, in adults, a kind of cathartic experience you referred to. The way that when you cry, there is a relief of whatever emotion it was that was building up.
And Michael, let's take a call from Chris in Sparta. He's waiting to talk to us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a tendency not to cry, and I'm just curious. I mean, I've never had any true tears come out of my eyes from any music whatsoever or any even, you know, tragic situation. I might get a lump in my throat, but that's pretty much as far as it gets with me, and I'm wondering, am I just a poor test subject, or are there others like me out there?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chris.
Right. That's very interesting. In one of the radio interviews I did back here in England, I did an email questionnaire, which we sent out electronically, asking for information only from people who never cried. So the norm is that people cry. The norm is that more females cry and cry more frequently than males. But the number of people who never cry is actually, well, larger or greater than one suspects. These problems have never been studied. A number of people are very concerned that they don't cry. And one of the problems is holding in emotional responses when others would prefer to release them. Now, there's, of course, a story embedded in literature, or if you like, in plays like Shakespeare's King Lear, whereby the suppression of tears leads on to, well, in Lear's case, certainly a form of madness, and the suppression of emotion can be very difficult for people. There's no studies about treatments. There's no studies about the adverse effects. But a lot of people have expressed the same, that they would really like to cry, but somehow hold it back. Now, if I could just say one more thing, it tends to be more with men than women. And if you go back a while, for men to cry, it was considered just not male, just not masculine. Nowadays, the media in America, for example, are happy to show President Obama crying or other famous sportsmen crying. They're happy to show film stars crying, males, that is. So the images of males crying on the media has become much more prevalent recently, and I think that's allowed men to feel that they don't have to suppress the tears when they get the feeling in the throat.
There's certainly a lot of social influence that might weigh into one's response to cry. Even if one is feeling like they want to cry, they might be too embarrassed to actually go ahead and do that, especially if it's in a public forum. But one thing that you also write about is that the muscles around our eyes can actually influence the way we feel. Why don't you talk about that just briefly?
Well, that's quite interesting because, you know, I'm sure I'm not speaking to anybody directly, but there have been some investigations on people who've had Botox injections alter the wrinkles around the eyes. And so when you do Botox injections, if you give too much and you alter the muscular activity around the eyes, so the eyes don't respond as they do when we cry, you actually, if you do then brain imaging, you show that the responses of those people from a brain imaging point of view, those bits of the brain that are activated when we are about to be emotional, actually don't activate particularly well. And so there is some feedback from the muscles of the face, but particularly around the eyes, to the central nervous system, which again is part of the reflex of bringing on the tears. And I think that actors use this. You know, if they have a reflex when they alter the muscular tension around the eyes, that this can lead to a reflex which then produces the tears. But these were investigations done with Botox.
Let's take we've got time for one more call, so let's go to Jim, who joins us from Osceola. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The poet Jane Kenyon observed how like the sound of laughing weeping is. And the other observation I had was there's parts of the Messiah that bring me to tears that has nothing to do with the libretto or nothing autobiographical for myself. It just seems to be maybe the juxtaposition of chords or whatever. It's just the beauty of the music itself that brings me to tears.
Jim, thanks so much for the call and a couple of things in there. First of all, you know, that sort of that idea that a piece of music can make you cry and you're not quite sure why, you just know that it does. But his first comment, the poem about that difference between laughing, another emotion, and crying, it's very interesting.
I think it is very interesting. We talked about people who don't cry and how little research has been done in that. The other aspect to crying is, of course, tears of joy. And tears of sadness and tears of joy do merge to some extent, but it is quite true that we do have tears of joy. I can just briefly tell you that recently the National Lottery here in England, I know you have lotteries in America, got in touch with me. Would we study what happens? Because they were fascinated that when people were given a check for $1 million, they would burst out crying, and they thought this was somewhat paradoxical. So we have been doing studies on tears of joy. And they are different from the tears of sadness or even maybe the tears brought on by music because they're quite short-lived. You know, people get over it very quickly, whereas the tears that relate to bereavements or indeed the tears that relate to musical experiences very often linger for quite some time.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, and great pleasure.
That was Michael Trimble, Emeritus Professor of Behavioral Neurology at the Institute for Neurology in London. He's the author of Why Humans Like to Cry, Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain. It's time for Wisconsin Life. When many people think of food rationing, they think of World War II. But Americans were first urged to conserve during the First World War, and many of the programs were pioneered in Wisconsin. Historian Erica Janik tells us how Wisconsinites learned to cut back on wheat, meat, fat, and sugar.
Meatless Monday isn't a new idea, nor is eating less wheat. During World War I, Americans cut down on meat, wheat, fat, and sugar. We patriotically filled our plates with dogfish, sugarless candy, whale meat, and horse steaks. We planted victory gardens and learned to love leftovers. President Wilson even grazed sheep on the White House lawn. Everyone was urged to do their part. The food crisis was severe. People in Europe starved as farm fields became battlefields. By the time the U.S. entered the war in 1917, 3 years of fighting had seriously damaged food supplies. So the addition of hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers presented a huge problem. As a farming state, Wisconsin took a keen interest in the food crisis. If anyone could help, it was us. Just 6 days after Wilson declared war on Germany, Magnus Swenson, chair of Wisconsin State Council of Defense, began promoting food conservation. He was very qualified for the job. Swenson had spent his career developing methods to make industries more efficient. Swenson first tackled food waste. He reduced fire hazards at grain elevators, warehouses, and other places where food was stored. He urged taverns to stop serving the traditional free lunch and commissioned scientists to study the health benefits of stale bread. So many farmers went to war that more hands were needed in the fields. Automobile squadrons brought older men and teenagers out to farms to harvest crops. So they wouldn't be a burden to farm families, they carried their own lunches. Women joined the war effort without ever leaving the kitchen. Meatless and wheatless days were the centerpiece of Swenson's food plan. Soon, the whole country joined in. Women learned to use corn and rye instead of wheat, chicken instead of beef, and to cook more vegetables. They signed pledges promising to conserve. The Women Students War Work Council and the UW Home Economics Department produced a wartime recipe booklet to show how easy it could be to cook with alternative ingredients. Recipes included steamed barley pudding, scalloped cheese, and something called salmon box, a loaf pan lined with rice and filled with cold, flaked salmon. Meatless and wheatless didn't just apply to home-cooked meals. Restaurants were also encouraged to adopt conservation menus. While meatless and wheatless days may have involved some form of sacrifice, it wasn't all that bad. Meatless meant no beef or pork. Chicken and fish were okay. In fact, Americans were urged to raise their own backyard poultry flocks. A meatless menu offered on the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad included a half a chicken and shredded crab on toast. More than a month after Swenson implemented his conservation measures in Wisconsin, Herbert Hoover was named the Federal Food Administrator. The Wisconsin plan soon became a national priority. When the fighting finally ended in late 1918, Americans had shipped nearly 10 billion pounds of meats, fats, dairy products, and vegetable oil overseas. Wisconsin increased its food production by 25% while sending 50,000 farmers to war. "Food will win the war," the government said. It was Wisconsin that provided the answer.
Wisconsin and the First World War, a special Wisconsin Life series, continues all this month.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30.
Here to talk more about the food rationing campaign of World War I is Wisconsin Life producer Erica Janik. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start out with a real basic question, which is, you know, why don't we know more about food rationing and conservation in World War I? World War II gets a lot of attention, you know, and maybe it's just because it's so much closer in our memory, but it seems odd to me that 100 years ago this happened and it was a big deal and now we've forgotten all about it.
Well, I definitely think that proximity in time does have something to do with it. I think we just don't know as much about World War I as we know about World War II because, you know, we're not living amongst people who lived through World War I anymore. And so I think World War II is just more present in our minds. I think a difference, too, is that in World War I, a lot of these programs were voluntary and things were more enforced and mandatory during World War II. So they came up with these ideas of how they were going to do all of these food conservation programs. But it's really in World War II where everyone was kind of forced to do it. And so maybe being forced rather than being coerced through colorful propaganda posters makes it stick in your head a little bit more.
So tell me more about the role of Wisconsin and this person named Magnus Swenson, which is a terrific name, but I've never heard of this person before. And what did he do and why did he become so important in this effort?
So Magnus Swenson was actually a Norwegian immigrant who had moved to Wisconsin, and he became really involved in the sugar refining industry. And one of the things that he was doing in that industry was really trying to cut down on waste and make industry more efficient. And so when the U.S. enters the war, Wisconsin was the first state actually to form these state councils of defense. And Magnus Swenson was named the chair of this committee. And before any kind of federal kind of organization could really get together, Magnus started just doing what he knew best, trying to make the state more efficient. These state councils of defense were extremely organized. There were county level committees, there were town level, really all different levels of groups working toward some kind of conservation measures. And the council's goal was really just education about what people could do for the war. And so he was really doing everything he could to teach people about what they could do to actually support the war effort, because people did want to get involved and they weren't quite sure how to do it. And so Magnus really came up with these kind of innovative programs to save meat and wheat and fat, sugar, things that were high in calories that we needed to send overseas.
And it's interesting, too, because the war had been going on for such a long time before America got involved. But it sounds like, in Wisconsin at least, that the public was ready to respond to these pleas. That they, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, yeah, well, whatever. But here it sounds like they just sort of stepped right up.
They did. You know, I think it's really kind of amazing when you look at it in retrospect. The Europeans had really been relying on the American Midwest to supply food during the war up until this point. And, you know, we had been reading for years about people in Europe that were starving. And so it wasn't really unknown, I think, to Wisconsinites. And so when the U.S. enters the war, you know, we're sending hundreds of thousands of soldiers overseas who also are going to need a tremendous quantity of food. And so we were really kind of prepared to step up our production. And people really did, you know, believed in this cause and wanted to do what they could to support it.
And at the same time, there were other organizations, too. So, for example, the University of Wisconsin played a role. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the University of Wisconsin played a very key role. Magna Swenson actually worked with the College of Agriculture to help farmers really try to increase their yield. The university put out pamphlets about what the most productive seeds were so that people would know, you know, these are the ones to plant. This is the way to go. They also sent out county extension agents who would visit with farmers and try to figure out, you know, how to reduce their waste. They were really trying to encourage farmers to put up a silo. Silos, also a Wisconsin invention, but this would really help cut down on waste of corn and grain. And they were also doing things through the home economics department. You know, they wanted people to change really the way that they were cooking, and people had no idea how to do that. And so the home economics department produced all of these recipe booklets to help people use alternative ingredients, you know, using things like cornmeal instead of wheat. So you find all kinds of recipe booklets that they're putting out, as well as classes that they're having. Extension agents would also travel to small towns in Wisconsin and teach classes for women on how to can and preserve, just so they could figure out how to actually make this work in their lives.
So kind of a three-pronged approach. They wanted to cut down on waste. They wanted farmers to learn how to be more efficient and so forth. And then they took a direct sort of shot at the home, and they wanted people to have gardens, to have chickens, can and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, all the things that, you know, people are still doing to this day, mm-hmm. the things that sound so new, you know.
And trendy.
Right,
and
exactly.
Hipster, yeah.
Backyard chickens, that's so new and interesting. But, you know, you find out that we've actually been encouraging people to do this for a century.
So how did they get the word out? We've heard about Magna Swenson, but was this, like in World War II, I know there was lots of slogans and so forth. Did we see the same thing in World War I?
Absolutely. You find a very coordinated propaganda campaign with all kinds of slogans. The most popular one related to food was probably "Food will win the war." You found that all over the place. But you also found things like "The seeds of victory ensure the fruits of peace." And "Food is a weapon. Don't waste it." There are also all kinds of window displays that lots of these local councils of defense, they would, you know, go to the local grocery store and put together some kind of elaborate display of, you know, vegetables holding hands. And sometimes they even did kind of macabre things. There's some women, I can't quite remember what town it was in Wisconsin, but they actually put a skeleton in their window to, you know, really get the point across that if you didn't save food, like, people were going to die. But they also had kind of fun and a little bit corny slogans like "Old King Corn is American born. A mighty fine food is he. He makes good bread or cakes instead. So we don't need wheat, you see." So kind of clever advertising through posters and these campaigns.
Yeah, hard to know how that would play in 2014 or 2017, but in 1917, it was really something. So we've only got about 30 seconds left, so lots of good lessons here. We don't want to waste. We want to be able to grow our own food. So after the war, nobody wasted any food. Everybody continued to grow chickens and all of that, or we just went back to...
We did kind of go back to the way we were doing it before. The food crisis kind of continued in Europe after the war. There were still major food shortages. And actually, Magna Swenson ended up going to Europe to help kind of teach some of those efficiency lessons in Europe that he had taught here in the U.S.
All right. Well, Erica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Erica Janik, producer and editor of Wisconsin Life.